Good morning. I'm Paul. I'm a compulsive eater. Welcome to the Sunday morning Men in Recovery panel of CEA Howe. What we're going to do is we're each going to speak for about 15 minutes, myself, Brendan, and Vincent, and then we'll have questions, Q&A, anything comes up, and that sounds about right. All right, so I'm going to begin. I'm going to go first. I'm Paul. I'm a compulsive eater.
Hey, Paul.
I'm grateful to be here. My abstinent date is September 14th, 2014. I think it's 680 days, something like that, right? Real close to that. I can check it on the computer in a second. Current weight loss of 30 pounds, about 50 overall, and that's a real boring way to begin. All right, so I just wanted to say, first of all, I've had a great weekend here. It's been beautiful. I loved coming out to Las Vegas. I love being here. I love being a part of it. I've been to this convention over the years. I've had some relapse in my story, which I'll share about in a second. And so I'm just really grateful, and I'm glad you all made it out today, and I hope you have a safe trip home. I love food. Let's go home. You know, I love food. My life was always like, hey, where are we going to dinner tonight? Let's have a discussion about it. Okay. We can keep discussing it. We can throw options around. We can, on our way driving there, we can talk about where we want to go eat. Once we eat, we can say, well, maybe we should have gone to so-and-so. On the way home, we can discuss it. My whole world is I just love food. I could just talk about it all the time. I certainly could eat it. And anyone that doesn't understand that, I don't understand them. Like anybody that goes, oh, we can just eat whatever. And they really mean it, because I like to say it sometimes, you know, like through my disease to try to keep people off my track that I have a problem with eating. I don't understand that. I've never understood it. I grew up back in Boston, in New England. I grew up in just a normal suburban town with a couple of parents and an older brother and two sisters and a dog named OJ. You know, we're going back a long time, named after the running back. And, I don't have much time to kind of give you what it was like, but I love to eat. I also, for a period of time, like to drink and do drugs, and that was a wonderful way to spend my teens. And about 16, I went away to a treatment center and lockdown facility for about a year. I got out and got sober, and so then, of course, my main obsession became food. I was always on diets. I was the first kid, I think, ever in my town to drink Tab in the fifth grade. Man, oh, man. Like, I drank a Tab recently, and I was like, wow, this is not – they've improved diet sodas. It's like you might as well drink gasoline. And so it just gave me headaches and everything. I just thought it was so funny. Oh, look, they have Tab at some beverage store where they have every soda under the sun and everything else. And so I was always on diets. I was, you know, fairly active as a kid and playing sports, so I kept in decent shape, you know, but I was always trying to diet early on. I remember dieting. I got to stop eating. I got to lose weight. I got to do this. And it didn't really help. You know, I played sports in high school. As I said, I was gone for my sophomore year and I came back. And so I would go to meetings and go out with people afterwards. This is our AA meetings. I went to college, and I was still struggling with my weight. And after my freshman year in college, I was in Arizona. I came back to Boston in a hospital in Natick, Massachusetts. And I remember walking in, and it's funny to this day now because it's kind of part of my story. It didn't really mean much, but when I remember the guy that greeted me there, he said, hey, how you doing? I said, good. I'm here. I'm trying to figure out I have problems with food and blah, blah, blah. And he says, well, you don't look like an overeater. I didn't know, what do you say to that? Like, you know, hi, I just drove here. I'm 30 years younger than anyone. I'm the only other male other than you. I'm this young college kid that sought out a meeting, and your greeting is, you don't look like a compulsive eater, an overeater, whatever he said. I don't know what overeaters look like. I was exercising at the time. I was in college. I was, you know, I don't know what compulsive eaters look. I don't know what they look like. I mean, I know what conventional thinking is, but I know for me it's all in my head. You know, it's what I look like is inside is I'm just in pain and I can't stop eating. And so anyways, I kind of blew that guy off a little bit. I listened to the meeting and I loved the message because I was there to hear the diet. Like, what are we doing here? And they said, no white flour, no white sugar, 3 meals a day. And I was like, great. I think I went to a couple other meetings that summer. And it worked. It worked. I didn't get a sponsor. I did steps. I didn't hear any of that. But I did lose weight. You know, that's five. I lost weight. I went back to college, and at the time, I was, those are my photos if you want to pass them around, yeah. And so People were like, wow, you lost weight. And what wound up happening in a short period of time is the weight came back. You know, you figure out that white flour, white sugar, if you're a real compulsive eater, you can pretty much figure loopholes with that pretty quickly. You know, three meals a day can be three feeding periods a day that just don't overlap. One ends, one begins. You know, it's not that complicated. And so that kind of started the peer feeling of when you get on the scale and you see the weight gain back in that pit of pain of like, oh, my God. How did that happen? It was like 20, 25 pounds, which was not a big loss at the time, but that like, wait a minute, what happened? Like, it just happens without me seeing what's going on. And so what happened is I moved to Los Angeles after college, and a lot of things happened, but basically in about 1996, I bumped into a friend who had lost a bunch of weight, asked him how he did it, and he said he was in CEA How. And I asked him to take me to a meeting. And we went to a meeting on a Sunday morning at the time it was in Brentwood, California, in Los Angeles. I walked in. It was packed. I saw a couple people there. And this one girl I knew and her mom was there. And the first thing the woman said when she smiled is, oh, good for you. I just felt so great. Like, what a great welcome. Good for you. And I was like, hey, thank good for me. And so I got it. Again, what's the food plan? Let me have it. Okay, well, weigh and measure. All right. I can do this. And I did the questions, but I didn't really answer the questions about my emotions. I was just answering them because it was a submit kind of thing. I'm like, this is what you have to do and how. You got to call these people. You got to make these questions. You got to go to these meetings. Okay, I'll do it. Okay, general kind of feeling. And I did it. And I stayed abstinent for about a year. And you'll see in there's a photo of me in just a towel. I apologize. But that was taken the morning in Spokane, Washington. That night, I relapsed. I'd stopped going to meetings very much, and I just, because I had it, I was fine. You know, I'm in AA, that's my problem. This other food stuff is kind of silly. Come on, guys, it's not really that big a deal. And I relapsed, and I went on another 5 or 6 year troubling run until 2003, and a lot of things had happened to me over the years. I just couldn't do this thing. I started dating a girl, and I suggested she go to See How, because I'm very good at telling you what to do. She went, she got abstinent, and I watched her weigh and measure her food every morning and call her sponsor, and I just would have to lie and sneak out to go eat sugar-free foods and all sorts of crap because I was doing things my own way. And she was very kind and compassionate, and she said, you know, there's this guy who's kind of like you. He's long-term sober, a little angry, you know, and he's abstinent in how. I think you'd like him. You should come meet him. And I did. And it was my buddy James is in the other room. And he, 2003, I went to a meeting with him because I wasn't ready for How yet. And I remember him talking to me afterwards. I did go to a How meeting, and I said, okay. And he said, listen, Paul, do me a favor. Just play this little silly game for 30 days with me. Make the calls. Go to the meetings. Just, you know, let's just pretend like we're doing it. And that appealed to me. So I started doing it, and I got abstinent. And I stayed abstinent. Is that another five? Or? And I stayed abstinent for about 5 years. And I would come to the conventions. I would host sometimes. I did all the questions and all the stuff that I went through. And it started to sink in a little more. I still saw it as a diet, honestly. But it was getting better for me. In 2008, I wound up relapsing over a series of events, and I have to be honest with you, the last year I was a little bit wonky. You know, it wasn't as clean as my first 4 years. And I went out, and it was just hell. It was hell. The first night I went out, I remember, like, I couldn't finish all the stuff I was trying to binge on, and I was like, well, I'll just throw it up. And I remember being like, we're not bulimic. And I was like, oh, wow, now we are. I was like, wait a minute, how did that happen? Like, how do we just pass that imaginary line? It's like people that are drinking and they smoke pot and they stay sober for 20 years, then all of a sudden they're shooting up when they go out. It literally is the same thing. It was horrific. And I tried to get back, and I would call James, and I would go in and out, and then I would go through nutritionists, I would go through trainers, I would take all sorts of supplements and performance-enhancing drugs to try to get in shape. That's 10. that led to a whole other level of relapse, because for me, like, being a compulsive eater, I'm compulsive as this thing, whether it's exercise, whether it's starving, whether it's eating, whether it's emotions. Like, my head was fixated on this stuff. And I went through a really hard time. It was not easy. I don't wish it on anyone. I got arrested for some shenanigans. I would go to Mexico and buy certain things and try and bring them back over the border. I got caught. I got stopped. I got arrested. It was a big mess. And I'm 24 years sober at the time, which is wonderful. I missed a speaking engagement that night because I was in jail. You know, I was like, how do you call someone and say, hey, you're the secretary of the Tuesday meeting. Listen, I'm not going to make it tonight. Why? Well, because I'm currently considered a threat to the United States of America down at the border because I'm a compulsive eater and I need these performances, blah, blah, blah. And I share that only because it's important, you know. The depths that I went. I came back briefly in 2012. I got about 4 months. I went out, and I would come back and forth to meetings, and I was just that guy that wasn't going to make it, you know? I would come in late. I would leave early. I would just be kind of, not obnoxious, but I just didn't get it. I just didn't get it. I would see my buddy Vincent all the time, and, you know, he'd be absent or I'd be absent or we'd both be, and we just kind of looked at each other and rolled our eyes like this whole thing was silly. I don't bring you into that, but the joke was on me, you know? And so to briefly finish in the last few minutes of what happened to me is I helped this guy get abstinent, a buddy of mine, 12-stepped a buddy of mine. I sponsored him for a while in how he got abstinent. I had not seen him in a year. I bumped into him. I was 215 pounds. I'm about 168 now. I saw him at a meeting. He looked amazing. I was in terrible shape, like that photo last night showed, the one in the hat. That was about that time. I left that. I went home. He called me and he said, hey, Paul. I said, yeah. He goes, Andrew. I said, hey, buddy. He goes, can I ask you a favor? And I said, sure. He said, will you allow me to return the favor of giving you the miracle of how? And I remember at the time I even said, well, if you put it like that, I'll help you out. And he started taking me to meetings, and he sponsored me, and he helped me get abstinent. And I went away for about a month working over the summer with a couple friends of mine, and they went out of their way to let me, it was this big thing, big production, blah, 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 and a lot of people involved. And these guys are really important. They're really dear friends of mine, and they instructed everyone that worked for us that whatever I wanted for food, whatever I needed, they would get me so I could stay abstinent. Beautiful. And I was lying. I was sneaking. I was sneaking food, and I was lying. And I remember one of the guys saw me. And I remember him just looking at me just like with half disgust and half just like, what? Like, what's wrong with you? You know? And he walked away, and a couple days went by, and I went to make amends to him, and I said, listen, man, I said, I promise you I'm going to go to CA Howe, and I'm going to get it this time. And he looked at me and I said, I hope, man, for you, I hope so. And I came back and I remember going to a meeting and I said to someone, I don't know, how do you do this thing? Like, really not lie ever. Like, really not put anything in your coffee without measuring, without doing anything, without it being weighed and measured. How do you do that? And someone went, it's easy. You see this right there? Those are 7 tools. Just do them every day and you'll be fine. And they said a little bit more heavy than that. And I said, this is it. Okay. And that's what I've done. And it worked. That was like 2 years ago. I would call the 3 people a day. If I changed my food, I would text my sponsor. That one sponsor left, and then I was lucky enough to have Brendan start helping me. And I just jumped full feet into how. And it's been amazing. It's been amazing. I've spent a lifetime in this program, and it was a brand new experience. And I would make the calls, and I would go to the meetings, and if someone needed the chairs set up, I would set them up. I physically go to as many meetings as possible. I urge all my sponsees to not do any phone bridge because these programs need to grow, and they grow by my physical presence being in the room. You know, I had a meeting when I went to in Houston over Christmas, and there was no one there. So these 2 people come in that are new, and I like went over in the corner. I pulled out the literature out of the closet, and I said, okay, and I just let it, and I just winged the thing, you know? And I was like, whenever I'm – is that it? I'm pretty much close with it. All right. Is that I was able to really – build this program, you know, one day at a time, myself, wherever I go. And I have to say the first year of my abstinence, I decided to, okay, I decided that I wouldn't do anything major. I would just spend the first year getting abstinent. And everyone that I talk to, everyone that's in, I just say, just get abstinent. Take the first year. Just go. Don't even worry about working out or any of that stuff. Just be abstinent. And that's all I could do. And I remember early on, they all went to dinner afterwards, and I went with them. And there's a group of people, about 15 guys, and I'm known in that world as kind of cocky. I mean, I'm 30 years sober now, but I remember them all being like, hey, you want something to eat? And I'm like, nah, nah, nah. And someone else was like, well, you know, like if you're short on money, I could buy it for you. And I'm like, no, you know, all the questions that come when people are just putting attention on you. And I said to them, I said, look, guys, I'm in a program called CEA How because of my eating, and it's just really hard for me right now. Please, no more questions. And everyone was like, okay, man, good for you. You know, I bumped into an ex-girlfriend who I owed an amends, and I said to her, hey, I'm in CEA How, I'm sorry, blah, blah, blah. And she went, wow, good for you. No, you know, before I would hide all that. Now I don't wear T-shirts and I don't dance in the parade. But now I tell people, I have an eating thing. And a lot of people go, oh, you're in OA. And I just say, yeah, because I just want to get them off my scent. But I let them know that I have a 12-step program, and that's why I'm carrying my Tupperware everywhere. That's why I have a teaspoon with me after that, whatever the heck it is. Like, that's why I do what I do. And it's been such a loving transition that no one has a problem with it. And that's been the beauty of me, you know? Like, I remember traveling with my family and other friends would be there. And no one notices when I weigh and measure. It's the weirdest thing. Like, I could put it down right in front of people and be like, and no one goes, what are you doing? It's like God keeps me unharmed now. It's the weirdest thing. A buddy of mine, I was out to dinner once, and he weighs in restaurants, and I asked him why, and he said, I just like the spiritual freedom it gives me. And I was like, wow, you're kind of Gandhi. But I get it now. Like, this whole program has brought me spiritual freedom. The outreach calls, the seven tools, that my part has just brought me spiritual freedom. And I never really saw it like that before. And I have surrendered to this process, and the benefits have been amazing. And I just want to share my gratitude for both these guys up here who I get to spend a lot of time with in Los Angeles. I get to talk to Brendan on the phone every day and Vincent a lot, and I see all the service they do. And I just love seeing men in recovery that can be great examples. And I remember early on, not to embarrass Brendan, but it might as well, right, John, I was talking to him about something, about service and about this program, and I remember early on going, you know, it's like this meeting, there's no one, this or that, or this people over there, the intergroup's kind of all over the place, and, you know, and how do we, you know, what do you, blah, blah, blah. And basically he said, well, maybe you should just join me out front. And I was like, oh, like lead by example. Like, go to a meeting. If you have a problem with intergroup, why don't you join intergroup? And I did join intergroup. If you have a problem with meetings, then go to more meetings or start them or be secretary or get involved. And I'll tell you, that example has helped me so much in this program. But my life, because of that, is completely unrecognizable today. It's amazing. I don't have time to go on anymore, and I apologize if I'm running on. But it's amazing today because of this program. I never thought it. Before, I always thought it was a little silly. I thought I was Mr. Important. I thought I had a big life, and I had no life, and I was dying, and I was a mess. I put all my energy into How, and that's really all I do now is just carry Tupperware and weigh and measure. And my life is massive is probably a weird word to use, but my life's unbelievable, unbelievable. Outsides, in all of it, it just all cleans up with the clarity, and it's all because of this program. And I'm really grateful today. I appreciate everyone. Being here, and I'm going to let these two gentlemen talk now. So thank you so much. 5-5-5.
Vincent, compulsive eater. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Thanks for a great chair. Well, let's just start with what it was like. Yeah. I grew up in a house where everyone is there. I shared about this a little bit this morning. There was no unity. Everyone was out for themselves. So I had to learn how to basically defend myself, to not be vulnerable to the neglect or the criticisms. And food, it was a combination of food, TV, and fantasy that took me out. That was my first addiction. So I would just sort of, I was the last of four born. My parents were 43 when they had me, so they were kind of tired. They were just sort of like, and so I had basically no structure. Whatever I wanted to do, I could do, and if they didn't want me to do it, I would just whine and beg until I got to do what I wanted to do, ultimately, because it was an alcoholic household, so people, they were busy with putting out other fires. So I was the one who, unless I got in an accident or something, was a good little kid sitting in front of the TV, eating, being quiet. Food, you know, it was comfort. It was such comfort back then. And it still is comforting. I still do love food. But because of the way what was like back then, I learned zero social skills. I still struggle with social skills. You know, I've been in other 12-step programs, like put your hand out and say hello. When you say hello, smile a little bit. Don't jump, hello, you know. And I was always wondering, why are they not responding to me better? Because it's like you said, it's the full package. We got to do everything here. And one of the things that I have been is a little bit, because of the food, it allows me to stay in the fog and very unclear about everything, about what the real issues are, about what my needs are. And so I would, even if you ask me what did I need or what makes me happy, I don't know. Sitting in front of the TV, eating, binging, and isolating, that is what I would have told you. Because I don't know how to connect with people. Even in our literature, it says our main problem is that we don't know how to have an honest connection with another person. So anyway, there's the food, and I just checked out. Even now, I can look like I'm connected and I'm here, and I can still check out. I have to be present, like, oh yeah, where did I go? You know, to bring myself back into the room. And so the food was just the most obvious symptom of what was destructive. But this can be destructive too. To keep me from feeling vulnerable, being here with you. So I ate when I was going through puberty. I just made a decision. Someone came back from summer school he was my other fat friend, and he was thin. And so I figured, shit, now I'm the fattest person in the school. So I made a decision to lose weight, which I did. And I grew. It was puberty. And I sort of transformed. But I was still 100% that person who could not have social, who had no social skills, no clue as to how to get what I needed, no clue as to how to be helped to anyone else. I still struggle with this. It takes a lot for me to realize other people have wants and desires and feelings too. It's not just about me, because I have always been so consumed with me. Thank you. So anyway, I ate. I would like my favorite activity would be to come home from school, which I hated, and binge on these things in front of the TV, and then pass out. And I remember my father always saying, "Why the hell is that kid always sleeping?" I was unconscious because I was doped up from flour and sugar, and passed out. This is like, you know. It started probably when I was like 6, 7, 8, 9 and continued. And my dad and I would sort of fight over the TV. He would want to watch the news, and I would want to sit in front of it and eat and watch cartoons. So anyway, I go into junior high. I lose the weight. My brother and I joined a gym, and I would go compulsively. Do you remember those machines with the belts going around your middle? I was a 12-year-old kid doing that, probably five times a week for a half an hour or so. So there was that. And some of the ways I tried, I've had liposuction twice, compulsive exercise, diet pills. Meth was my drug of choice when in the other program, so that's a great diet pill. And what else? Does anyone remember Schick for the Control of Weight? That was my graduation present to myself at 18 years old. Now, mind you, I was only 160 pounds then. I'm 148 right now. I have a 32-pound weight loss. And at that time, when I was 17 or 18 years old, spending $500 on this program was a lot. And it worked for 1 week. They hook you up to electrodes. We did have to record our food back then. It was a red checkbook kind of thing. And took you up to these electrodes, and they would say, imagine those are maggots and not little sugar particles on this round thing with a hole in it. They would try and, so it was just really weird. So that was one of the ways also. So I'm living in this family. Coming into Howe for the very first time was the only way I had learned how to eat three meals a day. I could never diet before. I did try Weight Watchers. It didn't work because I didn't know about three meals a day. I couldn't do it. I would either starve or binge. It was on or off. So I get into program. Get into the other program when I'm 24 years old. Still very guarded. I can go to meetings and to programs and still keep myself so separate. I know how to do all the things, how to show up on time, how to smile sometimes, I know how to do all these things, but of the true connection, it's still something I'm working on. I get sober. Come into Howe. When I turned 40, all the little tricks that I would do to keep the weight down stopped working. Just stopped. I actually met Beverly here at this meeting, and at that time she lived in LA. And I remember my first Howe meeting, Beverly was at that. And she was either the secretary or the speaker. But that was my first Howe meeting, I did not stay. And then a few years later, I came back to Howe. And we were at Hot and Dry, which is a big convention for the liquid program, and I saw someone picking at a barbecue, and he's like, I'll take these vegetables and this protein, and so I asked him what he was doing, and he told me, so he was my Eskimo. And so I've been in and out of Howe for the last 16 years. I had 5.5 years of abstinence at one time. I was the literature person for our intergroup. I was very involved, but still sort of not surrendered. Thank you. And so after the 5.5 years of abstinence, I went out, and it was like, a good 8 or 9 years of just sort of in and out. We never really left the program. We were always sort of here, coming in late, leaving early. Very important people. And then wondering why it never really worked. I remember going to a meeting about a year ago, maybe a little over a year ago, and I was like, okay, Brendan, he's got a good program. And I knew his wife. And okay, maybe I'll ask him to be my sponsor. And that went on for a couple of months of seeing him at meetings. And I don't know why, but I asked him one morning, and he said, sure. No hesitation. It's not like, well, I got a lot of sponsees, let me think about it, or, you know. And here's the thing. Part of my addiction is managing, manipulating, martyring, and mothering. So I'm a master manipulator. I would like to manipulate my sponsors. And he wouldn't have it. He wouldn't have it. Like, why didn't you call on time? That's our call time. I need that. I need the structure this program has and the someone to hold me accountable. Because before, I would always choose sponsors that I knew I could manipulate. Well, I couldn't manipulate you, John. So, you know, everything changed then. And it's been a process for the last year. I have 256 days of abstinence, a 32-pound weight loss, food, step, and inventory sponsor. I have, like, I think 4 commitments in this program and 2 in another program. You know, I learned in another program that if you don't show up 15 minutes early, you're late. Because it's so important for me to really be here, to not do the bare minimum. Because that's what I'll do. I'll do the bare minimum and then say, see, it doesn't work. You know? Again, who was I kidding? Myself. So I had a couple of slips, you know, because right now my abstinence date was, it'll be Thanksgiving if, you know, it continues. And I do think it will continue, but I am more frightened now than ever because I know on one side I'm really here, I'm not faking it, but the addiction is still here, and I'm also more vulnerable than I've ever been. Vulnerability is not something I've ever done. You know, we talk about Tupperware. You know, I was very self-contained. I didn't need anyone or anything. And the program will not work alone, not for me. So somehow I have to surrender to that, and I think I've made the surrender. And the thing that has happened recently that I think I'll just sort of end with has to do with, they talk about a connection with your higher power, sort of a bridge to the other side, to sort of a spiritual life, and how, well, for me, I was able to get about 95% of the way across. I'm always sort of looking at the other side, still doing the best I can and being surrendered and all that, but I still wasn't quite all the way across. And what I noticed in the last couple of weeks is that I'm on the other side, looking back, not knowing how I got that last 5% of the way. Something has happened that's never happened before. I've always been, okay, I'll go to meetings, I'll have the meetings be my higher power, I'll have the ocean or God. But now, I actually can say, I have a higher power. I don't exactly know what it is, but I can look back and I can ask for direction all day long. Okay, what would you have me do and be right now? That's never been because I was still on self-propulsion, on sort of I'm doing it. And I loved the speaker yesterday. She was talking about, you know, we're here to be of maximum service to God and to our fellows. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Vincent.
Can I do 555 for you?
No, let's just do 15.
All right, and here is Brendan.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brendan. I'm a grateful compulsive eater. I love you guys. These two are very important in my life, as are all of you, even the ones I don't know. And thanks for coming here today. Today I have 2 years, 7 months, and I think 5 days, maintaining a 63-pound weight loss. And I'm just grateful to be here. I wasn't expecting in the men in Seahaw to be so moved, so thanks for that. Men crying with men, this is good. But that's sort of the topic of what I want to talk about is the, you know, I'm going to try to remember what it was like before I came into program. And the expectations that come with manhood in general. So I also grew up in Massachusetts in a small town. And along with that came, and I wrestled in high school. And along with that, small town mentality and also just, you know, losing weight for a sport, came this sort of, you know, there's this expectation that that we're supposed to be, at least for me, the way I grew up, that we're supposed to be big, strong, especially the guys in my neighborhood. Believe me when I say nobody's talking about their gene size and whether or not we're 10 pounds overweight. It's the norm, especially my wrestling team. We all grew up to be 70 pounds overweight. But even the, you know, quote-unquote normal people, it's like, I think where I grew up, it was a, you know, oh, you gain 30 pounds as you get older. Of course you do, you know. That's life. That's what happens. So, you know, we're a bunch of guys walking around with extra weight on us. And I remember my mom at one point, because I was losing so much weight as a wrestler, and I am somebody that qualifies on both ends of the spectrum of this disease, so just to give you some numbers, I weigh 165 today. At my heaviest, it was about 235. But in high school, my 4 years of wrestling were 112, 119, 121, and I couldn't stay at that weight, so 128, and then 135. And I could not for the life of me gain above 140. I tried and tried. My mom at one point said, you know, I think you're going to be the world's first anorexic boy, which is... Now, when you take that statement, what that really says is, first of all, it's a complete inaccuracy. Of course, there's anorexic boys, men, whatever. But it was a ding on my manhood. You know, it was, you are just like the, you know, I always joke around. My mom, she was a great lady, but she had some strange sensibilities, and sometimes she raised me like a, you know, like a. Southern Belle, you know, it's like, don't answer the phone after, you know, before two rings. Why? Because people think you're desperate. It's like, okay. You know, she had some strange ideas. So one of them was, you know, just, I had mixed messages growing up. I had that sort of world's first anorexic boy, but I also, believe me, when I started gaining weight, she's like, wow, you're looking like you should probably start hitting the gym or something, you know? So there was this... there was this medium that I could never find, and I had this number in my head that you know, if I hit this number in weight, everything will be fine. You know, I went into the Army. I went into college, developed a drinking problem. That certainly helped put the weight back on. If I was concerned about not getting above 140, that certainly did it. So. But all along, it's like I always had this thing in my head of just this self-hatred, total demoralization since the time I didn't feel necessarily good in high school at 128 pounds at 5'9", but I also, I didn't feel good at 235. I always had these levels of like, it was a progressive disease for me. So it's like, all right, if I get above 170, I hate myself. So I got to exercise like crazy to keep below 170. All right, if I get above 190, I hate myself. So I got to exercise. Okay, if I get to 210, okay, if I get to 220. And, you know, I loved what the speaker said yesterday where she said, you know, my 100 pounds is your 5 pounds. It doesn't matter what the number is, but it's that thing, that razor in your head, that's that demoralization, you know, for me was such a deep self-hatred. That I had no answer for it. So there was always this macho kind of size and power thing. Now, meanwhile, for those of you that do know me, and I alluded to yesterday, for those that don't, my wife is in the program. She's been in the program for, I think, 15, 16 years or so. So here I am in an half-abstinent household. We're like Jack Spratt and his wife. And she's eating abstinently. I'm not. And I'm watching the program work. I'm watching it work for 12 years because I'm slow to learn. What's interesting is these two men who I love so dearly, and, you know, if you were paying attention, spoiler alert, sponsor both of these guys. But, and I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to, I think I've mentioned it to you. I don't know if I mentioned to you. My wife, Deborah, she'd be like, you know, in that, there was one point I was so demoralized with this, I would hit myself in the face. That's just sort of one of those things I used to do, you know, where it's just like, definitely not this gentle, but it's like, you're so stupid, you're so this and that. And I'd hit myself hard. And she just, it was tough for her to watch. And she said, why don't you just go to a meeting? And I remember saying to her, and this was a perennial conversation. This happened whenever I would get to that point. I said, who the hell is in there telling my story? And it's like, you know, I've been to meetings. I've given you candles. Who's in there for guys? She says, what about Vincent? What about Paul? And I think at the time, this is the beauty of this program. I think by the time I hit bottom, you guys were both out. Yeah. But it's one of those things. It's like we are the minority. And in this program, we have a very anti, and even in this country, I'm going to say this is my own personal opinion, not CEA House, but we have a very antiquated idea of the disease, that it is for women, that it is for older people. It's only for when you get health problems. And, you know, it's almost the equivalent of, you know, who suffers for this disease? If we were going to do our own big book, it would be, you know, to the husbands. You know, just like with AAs to the wives, and it's just not true. You know, there's many of us in here, but it is a minority. It feels in LA right now, currently, and I hope it's not an ebb and flow. I hope, you know, that it's growing. I love that our two big books yesterday were two gentlemen. I think that's fantastic, and we've got a couple other LA guys here, a gentleman over here. Welcome everybody, and. You know, I'm just I'm happy to see the program have more guys and more male voices, because I think it is something that years from now we're going to look back on and say there was a time where guys couldn't go in there because they felt like it just didn't apply to them. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about sponsoring guys, because I do know people that, you know, women that sponsor men as well. What's interesting is, you know, we're a program that goes deeper. If you haven't seen that in action, take a look at, you know, 150 to 170 questions in the inventory. That's pretty deep. But one thing you'll find with men when you're sponsoring them, you know, unless they're a blabbermouth like I am, a lot of times it'll be, was there any deep, you know, sexual problems in your family history? Yeah. And that's the answer you'll get. You know, it's like, and so when you are sponsoring men, you get those one word answers. I think it's really important that you have to be a little malleable with the inventory. So you have to, at that point, you know, guys that don't write or they don't express themselves like that, I feel it's my responsibility as a sponsor to draw it out a little more. So if it is something of, you know, what's your compulsive eating history? I've always overeaten. Okay, but so, well, how did that make you feel? And then the conversation can start. You know, did you always overeat? Did you feel good about it? No, I always kind of hated myself. What does that feel like to hate yourself? Do you have it? You know, and it becomes this verbal conversation if it's not on the written page, because it's important. And I'll share. Hopefully, it doesn't embarrass you too. But when you said it, there was no hesitation. It's like, oh yeah, I'll sponsor you. There actually was a hesitation for both of these guys, and what it was, and they both looked at me saucer-eyed, was, I'll sponsor you. We're gonna do the inventory again. And it was like, hey man, I've already been in the program. It's like, I haven't heard your inventory, and I also am a believer. If you're struggling, then something was amiss in that inventory, possibly. So we did. We went through it again, and you know, I think that's a big piece. And I think for men, it's something that, again, where, you know, this is just my own personal opinion, but for where I grew up, it's sometimes tough to feel like it's okay to just express my emotions to get deeper, and especially with another person, it takes a lot of courage. I also just wanted to mention a couple more things. One of them is, you know, you hear the joke in CEA How of how quickly men lose the weight, you know, and women will joke. It's like, oh, we hate you guys. You lose the weight so fast. And I have experienced, you know, guys around me. I think we do sometimes, for some of us, lose the weight very quickly. And there's this movie, it's a baseball movie called Bull Durham. And at one point he says to the, you know, there's this pitcher that he's mentoring, and he says, you know what your problem is? You got $1 million arm and you got a 5 cent head. And so for us in CEA How, when you are sponsoring men, it's important that it's like, we'll get that $1 million body very quickly, but we still have that 5 cent head, you know? So we don't stop working together just because all of a sudden all three of us are at maintenance. There's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of spiritual depths to be explored. And you know, may we all remember that it's, you know, for myself too, my sponsors in this room as well. And you know, it's one of those things that we can always go deeper with this program. So, you know, when we hear about that it's not about the weight, with men sometimes will really experience that, and you'll see guys hit that weight and then all of a sudden it's like they're out, because we have to do the work. If anybody's in here, and it's funny, I've had people come up to me and be like, I would love you to be my husband's sponsor, or I'm sure they've said that to you guys. It's like, hey, you know, I've got my husband, I'd love for him to come into the program. And one of the things I'd like to say, a little shout out to my wife, is that she just watched me plod along in denial for 12 years, you know, and it's like, you really cannot lead that horse to water, or you can lead him to water, but you can't make him drink. And she, I always like to share, I would be in sort of my binge cycle, and she'd say, hey, I went to such and such place and got you healthy food. And I'd be like, do me a favor, don't order my food for me, okay? I'll take care of my food, when I was in the binging. But I will say, you know, if you do have somebody and they do start to, it's almost like you just got to keep your ears out, because if they're going through what I went through, they may be coming with you to meetings and saying, I don't know that there's a lot of guys. I also want to encourage anybody that is out there, you know, whether it's in Las Vegas or you're from other areas or you're listening to this online, there's a lot of us in Los Angeles. We're really blessed to have a lot of guys in Los Angeles. And I think I can speak for most folks where I can say, get one of the intergroup numbers, ask what men you got in program. I know I'm happy to talk to anybody on the phone, and I know that you two are as well. I hope.
Yes.
I want to thank, and we're going to open this up to questions. I want to thank everybody for being here, and grateful to have you, and thanks for letting us share.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Brendan. Okay, so if someone asks a question, they have to sign the consent. Is that correct?
Yeah.
All right, got it. So we're going to open it up to questions. So if anybody would like to ask a question to anybody on the panel.
Derek Kapalsavider.
Hey, Derek.
How you doing? Oh, I guess my first question, what's just kind of is like a open, but what's the greatest lesson that you learned in life, either from CHOW or to this point going through on your recovery journey? What's the greatest lesson you've learned?
Hey, Vincent.
Okay. Vincent Kapalsavider. Just that it can't be done alone. Like with diets, you can go and nothing can be done alone. Life is about a communal experience, and that it's safe to be around safe people. And I never knew that. It was always sort of the mask. So that we do this together. They even say the first step says, we admitted we were powerless. And it's always we. There's even a we version of the Serenity Prayer. So that, because I am hardwired to do it alone. So I have to constantly be aware that it doesn't work that way for me. Thanks.
Hey, Derek. I'd say for me it's service. And for whatever gratitude these two pitch towards me, it's nothing compared to the gift that I get for working with them. These guys keep me abstinent, and it's service to other people. I'm not somebody who comes to that naturally. And I don't know what anybody in the room thinks of me chairing this convention, but that's not me. That's this program. And it was given to me really early on, where I was trying to do my program and still leave my life. So now all of a sudden I'm putting this little puzzle piece of like, okay, my old life and now this program thing. And at one point I because I did have the blessing of having an abstinent wife, I said, can I ask you a question? How many phone calls do you make a day? She goes, what do you mean? I said, I'm telling you, I'm losing my mind. By the time I get these outreach calls and I make my outreach calls and I call my sponsor, I mean, I have to be on the phone. And she goes, can I make a suggestion to you? Don't do the math. She goes, that's the price for the big life. And what I really realized was once I surrendered that there's a difference between my life with program and leading a program life. Today, I lead a program life. And that's something that it's a daily reprieve. I don't come to it naturally. I come to it because I show up at these meetings. I show up and do service. I look everybody in the eye. If I don't do that, I go right back to the couch. And so the program life has been, like Paul said, my life is unrecognizable from what it was. And you hear a lot of people in these rooms say, I got my life back. I never had a life to speak of. This is something new. I have a life. And it's all through service. You know, it's one of those things that when I first came in, they said, you know, make the coffee. It's like, oh, I get it. You make the coffee, so you show up to the meeting on time. You have to go, or it's like, oh, you know, I have the key to our Sunday meeting. It's like, oh, I get it. I have the key, so I have to be there. And it's like, no, we were talking about this the other night. It's like, it's the esteemable act that comes from I did something for all of you, and you don't even need to thank me. It's just it, but in here, it just makes my life so much more joyous. You know, whenever I can take the focus off of myself, my life becomes much more joyous.
Amen. I think that's good. Yeah, you guys nailed it.
Sure.
Next question.
Follow-up question would be, how important is journaling? That's something I struggle with, is trying to write each day and trying to open up. So it's how important was that in your recovery?
That seems like something he's very fond about.
These guys will tell you. I think Vincent said he does 3 out of 5 days. He actually does probably 4 out of 5, and he hears about it when he doesn't do the fifth. But it's, you know, it's very important. What I love about our program and the tools is that we have the opportunity to check in with our compulsive disease for however many minutes. And again, with guys, you know, Deb's like, you guys are on the phone for a short time. She's like, I said, how long are you on the phone? She goes, oh, we'll talk for 15 minutes. It's like, no, sometimes we'll wrap it up in like 2 minutes, you know. And that's kind of a guy thing. But we do have an opportunity when we answer a question to check in with our compulsive disease once a day. And what a miracle that is. You know, there's other programs out there. Some of us are in them. Some are not. I love that our tools are a requirement. And the writing is one of the requirements. It's one of the essential tools of our program.
I agree. One of the things I want to say that was beautiful, because Brendan has always been a big encourager of writing, and I had to do the inventory over again, which was correct, and I didn't want to, but this time I had a different experience because my judgment of the first time I did it was I thought the questions were a little bit creepy and silly and odd. I thought they were dumb, frankly. And he said, well, just do it again with an open mind. And I asked someone else, too, and they said, well, this time pay attention to the wording of the actual question and answer it as specific as possible, meaning, did you have any weird childhood feelings if you saw an adult man naked? There's a question like that. And I was like, okay, it's asking me not if I've ever seen, but if I had any uncomfortable feelings. And when I answered that, it opened a door that led to me making a breakthrough with all sorts of stuff. mainly being that I had a lot, I was very uncomfortable. I would get a lot of compliments from a lot of people, some in my family, about my physicality and how I looked, and that is extremely uncomfortable for one. Two is impossible to talk about as a man, because they're like, what did you say? We're from Boston. Like, oh, you think you're too good looking for this room? Like, they're like, no, man, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that when people are like, hey, you look nice today. It's like, why do they got to rub me? And I apologize. But it's horrifically uncomfortable when it's in a family setting. And we can leave it at that for this room in Sunday morning. But I will say that when I was going to read that to Brendan, I was like, I don't even know if this is real. Because I didn't want to say it. And he said the most beautiful thing to me. He said, hey, man, it's real if you say it is. And that was the beginning of just an opening up of everything from the writing. And so thank you for that. And that was a great question. And
the only thing I could add is that sometimes it takes me 3/4 of a page to get to something that's a little bit more. I'm like all the sort of blah, 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 blah. And it's, so I have to write at least a page to get to that bottom portion, which is actually has more substance for me.
I see. When you first entered the program with the women to men ratio, did you feel really uncomfortable, or are you completely comfortable being in a room full of women sharing your stuff, or is it still a challenge? I guess my question is, what's your advice with someone that uses that as an excuse not to go? That's really, I guess, the core of it.
Yes. Yes, I am. Yes, I am uncomfortable with that. Absolutely. When I came in, I was tremendously uncomfortable. Because I thought everyone was different in the room. You know, like I thought like that I was in a room full of old ladies, for instance. That would be the statement. But what happened is, me would joke about it, when I started doing the tools, I would go into that room, and I loved these women. And I felt that, like, you know, not to sound like an after-school special, but I realized that we're all the same. And when I went in with an open mind and an open heart, everybody, it didn't matter who was in the room. Like, it's amazing how much that's changed. And I would joke with him, like, I remember one time we were leaving a meeting, and I was stunned because a woman that I had resentments at for years in meetings was now like my favorite person on the planet. And I remember it was a Monday afternoon, and I was in a parking lot with him. The sun's out. It's like a normal fall day. And I'm like starting to cry. And I'm like, I can't, what is going on here? And he was just like, it's going to be okay, man. Because I was literally so moved spiritually of the beauty of this thing, of how it works, of like, you and I are compulsive eaters. It's like, that's what we got, you know? And to be able to come in a room and really hear that me and a 70-year-old woman from the Bronx who may root for the Yankees is the same as a guy from Boston that roots for the Red Sox, or someone that grew up in England, or, you know, in the phone bridge. That's the amazing thing, is hearing people from all different walks of life, and sponsoring people from all different walks of life has been an amazing realization that, you know, we're not different. But I absolutely did feel different at the beginning, and I felt very uncomfortable, and it got easier with time by when I did the tools.
No, that was good.
Derek, do you feel comfortable right now talking about your bottom in the room? Like, what got you in the room?
What got me in the room?
What got you in the rooms, yeah.
I feel, I guess, because I can try to expound on it. I think someone talks about being socialization, but what got me in the room, I know I often hear people say I don't look like it, but when it comes to compulsive eating, it was, I was in the military for 11 years. I got out because of budget cuts, and I was in a route to get married, but that kind of fell through. So I was eating, I was gaining weight. I tried to out-exercise my eating, and that wasn't working. you hear it in the health community. I was going years not really being able to experience when I was hungry and when I wasn't hungry. So I lost my sense of when am I full and when am I hungry. I started to get crazy heartburn every day, still eating even though I have heartburn. I've had 4 or 5 meals. Started getting rashes on my skin coming and going. I'm hiding it from people. I'm hiding food. I even lost when I couldn't remember the last time I drank water. I couldn't remember the last time I didn't eat sweets or something. Not only when I would buy a donut or something, I would either eat the whole box in one night or in one sitting. And it wasn't always a whole binge. Sometimes it was just grazing for a whole week. I'd go through a box in over 3 or 4 days, not necessarily in a whole in one sitting. But
and how did you feel about all that when that was going on?
Someone said demoralizing. I couldn't even put say a word on it. I know I knew I had a problem. I figured that I just figured out I felt hopeless. I felt pain. I felt like I just had to buckle up and figure it out on my own, and I didn't really know what to go about it, and I just felt it was going to be a phase and it would go out, and it never did. So it was just really just felt like I was going crazy, I guess. That on top of what was going on in my mind, on top of that, that is that I'm just kind of lost, hopeless in this wilderness, and I don't know if I'm gonna get out of it. I want to be better, but I don't necessarily know how. So
okay, that sounds like a bottom. Does that sound like a bottom to you guys? So you said hopelessness,
mm-hmm.
crazy. What else? Demoralized.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want you to hear. Your question is, do you feel uncomfortable sharing that in a room? And to you, I would say, look at the alternative. So you're coming into a room and you're sharing these things, and you're feeling a little bit of discomfort with everybody in the room. But the alternative that you just described, do you remember what that felt like?
Yeah.
So what's easier?
It's easier to share in a room than to go through that. And
yeah, and it is uncomfortable sometimes. But, you know, we're all doing this together. I don't, when you were sharing, I saw heads nodding. I don't think there's anybody in the room that doesn't know exactly what you were just talking about. You know, it's that commonality we all have in here. And thanks for sharing it.
Thanks.
You're on a roll. You got any more questions? Feel free.
I know I have a 3-year-old. I'm a single parent. I get him every 2 weeks. And I know one thing I struggle with is how to change my food, and I need to be an example to him. So sometimes I give him snacks, sometimes I don't. What have you had sponsors that had children, and what's the best advice that you give them for people that have children? I don't know if that's.
I don't think none of us have children, unless Paul's got somebody in Alaska that he hasn't told us about. But there are a lot of people in the program that you can definitely talk to about that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. One gal's working literature right now. You can go and talk to her. Mm-hmm. Young blonde lady over there. She's got 3 kids that she raised. I don't think any of them eat abstinently. And I also know other people in the program that have kids that don't eat sugar. So I think it's part of it is your specific journey, but also just reaching out to other people. You know, great topic for outreach calls, since you got to make 3 a day anyway.
I got a buddy that's a single dad who's abstinent. I can give you his number.
Mic it up.
Okay. Yeah. Other question. I mean, I'm going on a men's retreat camping, and I'm right now, I don't know what I'm going to do to remain abstinent because I don't necessarily have a refrigerator. I don't know if you have any advice on someone going on a camping trip. Do I cancel the trip, or do I?
Yeah. I travel constantly, and so I understand. And John is good with this, too, which is I – depends on how long you're going for and all
like
that.
3 days, yeah.
Yeah, that's possible. A lot of times what I'll do is, you know, there's some simple tricks of you try and find things that don't obviously perish, you know, which just seems like common sense, you know, mm-hmm. canned things or, you know. There's a lot of, you know, you can talk to your sponsor about that. But specifically, you know, what I don't recommend is you, like, take a like food from the dinner last night and put it in your bag when no one's looking for your ride home today, which is what I did. I'm just kidding. And that wasn't me. I didn't take any of those rice cakes. And so that was not me. But, you know, there's a lot of specific tricks that I've used where I'll freeze things and then they thaw out over a day or two, which seem to work when you're camping. A lot of dry goods, a lot of canned things work well. Canned juices are terrific, you know, vegetable juices, all these things. I mean, like, you know, as a friend of mine, ours says in Los Angeles, like, it won't be sexy, the meal, but it's fine, you know. And a lot of these things that we're talking about, they will last for 2 or 3 days, you know, especially I have coolers. I have like a plug-in cooler for my car, which obviously you can't take camping, but I have a lot of those things I've used now, and I've really studied it. And John can probably give you some tips too if you ask him after the meeting, but that would be my suggestion, you know, is the prep work. I don't know if I really helped answer the question. I can give you my number. You call me too.
It gave me got my mind. Good. A lot of different options.
Yeah.
I'd say, okay.
Good.
So it is possible. So
let's have you sign this over here.
Okay.
Anybody have another question? Yes.
Hi, good morning. I'm Diana from Austin, compulsive eater.
Hi, Diana.
And first, I wanted to thank y'all for doing this. I was curious. I wanted to come to this meeting to see what the men had to say, and I'm grateful to have y'all in our program. I wish there were more men. I do have a question. There's a new men's meeting that's been approved on the phone bridge, and that's going to be starting, I think, August 2nd. And the information is on the website, but I was curious as to, you know, it's a men's only meeting. What would be the difference in a men's only meeting than a regular meeting that had men and women? What type of value do you see in having a gender specific meeting, and what types of things might be said differently there? Or I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think it was just shared beautifully that, you know, there's times where people feel uncomfortable, especially if there's some deep-seated things that might have to do with, you know, family of origin, the things that we do hit in the inventory. I think sometimes that if somebody, like it was just shared, if they find a men's meeting and it's like, oh, I actually feel more comfortable in the room with just guys in the room, that gives them the opportunity to kind of feel that camaraderie. And I think that, you know, it's a good bonding thing too. Like even just doing this workshop to just realize it's like, yeah, we are a contingency in CEA Howe, you know? So to have a men's SAG meeting or whatever they're calling it, like I actually just wrote it down because it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Right now we don't have one in Los Angeles. We had one closed from lack of attendance. So I think it's important to see if that, you know, has the ability to gain attendance and for people to be able to share openly if they feel more comfortable with everybody in the room being the same sex.
Hi, Terry, compulsive eater. How do you make friends with guys, especially if you're a woman, and especially if the idea might be like, see how older women? And I know you said that you see women as fellow compulsive eaters and so on, but how does one like become just friends with guys in program or outside?
You know, I mean, men and women are different. My thing has been, I have a really hard time expressing myself. And so when women express themselves a lot, I sort of shut down. So it's more of the balance thing. You know, I heard it once said that we don't have to be talking all the time. We can be quiet and just let our spirits talk to each other. So I would say that it's, you know, men need to speak up a little bit more and maybe women need to speak a little. That's the only thing I can say that sort of comes to mind, because it is, even with the previous question about what's different in a men's meeting, women are much better expressing their feelings. We need a little bit more space of just dead space in order to get it out. And yeah, that's the only thing that I can think of. So.
That's a good question. How do you be friends with guys? Is, you know, for me, I love program, because it helps me have a very full life, a weighed and measured life, and a balanced life, and I'm very clear on boundaries and all that. as far as whatever that word even means. But for me, it means that, you know, when I come to these meetings, I'm really here to get help and to help others, you know, achieve abstinence. And that's really my only goal. You know, I'm not really a big socializer or try to be. I don't, you know, in other programs it makes sense, but in abstinence it's a little bit more difficult. We're not really a group that loves to go eat together after meetings. We would, but, you know, we usually weigh and measure and carry our things. And even providing drinks, it's like we all bring our own, we know we're kind of, we got that on lockdown, so we don't really need a lot of that. Like, I'm involved in the intergroup in Los Angeles, and we're always like, well, we should have drinks or things. And I'm like, we're not a big drinks and things group. We can bring them, but usually we wind up having them afterwards because everyone always brings them because we are not people that go unprepared anywhere. And for me, it's been two parts. Part one is, like what I shared earlier, again, hard to share. I'm always a little hesitant, you know. I don't really sponsor women. I did a little bit, like I'll help retreads the first 30 days, but it's not really my thing. I don't think appropriate's the wrong word, but for me, I'm just not comfortable with it. I'm not a guy that shares a lot of feelings to begin with men, so a lot of times guys that are very sensitive, they don't work for me, and I've been working on that, so me trying to relate to a woman can be difficult, but I do right now, so I do take part in it. But to answer that question, it depends on what my goal is, what your goal is. You know, for me, there's nothing to get from anyone in this program other than to help. That's really all I'm here. And when my motives are clear, I can be friends with women. If I want something from them, whether it's a business or I'm like trying to date them or something like that, that's when it gets very weird very quick. And so that's all I would say is the key is for me is just if my motives are clear and someone else that I'm interacting with, I feel that their motives are clear, then I'll be open with them. But if not, I'm going to certainly have boundaries and be hesitant. And I suggest that everyone else does the same. You know, does that help?
You want to wrap it up?
Yeah. Okay, so we're done, right? Okay, this is it. All right, so thank you all for coming out. Let's give a round of applause for Vincent and Brendan and me, Paul.